Welcome back to the Zeitcast, where we talk about the intersection of theology and culture. Gotta say, this is one of the episodes I have most looked forward to doing ever. And Dr. Newberg, I'll just say this right at the gate. Not only have I been excited about this, now I'm a fan. Far and away, my wife, Nicole, is just freaking out about this. She is a huge fan, like a monumental fan. This is the first time I've ever had a conversation I think Nicole thinks is really cool. So I feel so much cooler to my wife right now to be able to have you on the podcast. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate it. Tell her I said hello then.
I will do that for sure. Dr. Andrew Newberg, a neuroscientist who studies relationship between brain function and various mental states. He's a pioneer in the neurological study of religious and spiritual experiences, a field known as neurotheology. His research includes taking brain scans of people in prayer, meditation, rituals, and trance states in an attempt to better understand the nature of religious and spiritual practices and attitudes. I love your new book, Sex, God, and the Brain. Certainly want to talk about that, but also certainly given my background, books like How God Changes Your Brain and Neurotheology, How Science Can Enlighten Us About Our Spirituality. Incredible resources. So once again, welcome to the Zeitcast. Just a thrill to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay. So I want to establish some bio and a sense of story as we go, but I thought we'd start with a fun jump into the deep end of the pool kind of question. So okay. My background, I always say I'm a hillbilly Pentecostal, like my father and grandfather, both Pentecostal preachers. These days I exist at all kinds of interesting intersections, but I still feel like that fundamental orientation around the spirit and turned me into a mystic and has established so much of the trajectory of my life. So I thought, here's a great warm up.
Sure.
What do sex and speaking in tongues have in common from a neurological perspective?
Wow, that's interesting. I haven't put those two together yet. Taking a big step back, part of what I often talk about in the context of the brain and religious and spiritual beliefs and practices and so forth is that, you know, there isn't just one part of our brain that turns on when we are religious or spiritual. So when you walk into church, there isn't one area of the brain that just suddenly kicks in. It's lots of different parts of the brain. And I think for anyone who's religious, they appreciate that because sometimes it's cognitive, you're reading the Bible. Sometimes it's emotional, you feel, a great sense of uplift or joy or something like that. Sometimes it's experiential and you're hearing things or seeing things or behavioral, you're speaking in tongues, whatever. So it's all parts of our brain that can become involved. And as someone who's in the world of integrative medicine, the brain and the body are intimately connected. So if there's a spiritual part of ourselves, it's really all of us, which I think, makes a lot of sense. And so it really just depends what we are doing that kind of activates the system in different kinds of ways. And so in some sense, the answer to your question is that when you look at things like sex and sexuality and the sexual experience, that involves a lot of the same basic brain areas. And in fact, part of the argument, at least from a biological perspective, is that, when you talk about our positive emotions and feelings of ecstasy and feeling connected to another person, like in sexuality or mating, or feeling connected to a group or feeling connected to God, there's that feeling of connection. So there's a lot of overlap in the areas of the brain that are involved in our emotional processes, our sensory processes, this feeling of oneness and unity that ultimately become kind of a part of all the different things that we experience as human beings. And that's why when you have a very powerful kind of experience like speaking in tongues, the emotions and all the elements that are part of that are also part of, one of the other most intense kinds of experiences we have, which is the sexual experience. And so I think there's actually a lot of overlap in many different areas of the brain. And that's part of what we were, what I was exploring in that book, which is, how do we actually kind of understand all of those different connections? Because I think it's actually fairly complex. It's fairly intimate and fairly intricate. And so to me, that's part of the real point of all of this, which is that We have a brain that is built to have some incredible experiences. And so we use a lot of the same parts of our brain, irrespective of how we get to those experiences.
That's so good. Well, and I thought of the question partly even just from a drive-by reference, but knowing that you have both done brain scans with folks experiencing sexual intimacy, but also speaking in tongues and thinking like, right. But just that sense of the transcendent and the things that, we both experience in our bodies, but in a way can feel like sort of transcend some of the normal categories. I love this about your work in general, because I'm such a fan of exploring these intersections. What I think is so cool about what you do, among many other things, is that you clearly are a lot more conversant in theology and philosophy than I am in neurology. So you know plenty about my lane, whereas I don't know nearly as much as about yours. I'm so curious, though, given your field, where did that search begin for you, even of exploring the transcendent through your work and these intersections of philosophy and theology? Because obviously this is not something everybody's doing. So I just love to hear a little bit of kind of your origin story in terms of why these intersections lit up for you.
Well, you know, a lot of it did, it began way back when I was a kid. I was always kind of confused as to why people believe different things. I felt like, if we're all looking at the same world, why do we have different political views? Why do we have different moral views? Why do we have different religious views? Why shouldn't we all kind of look at the world exactly the same? And so my sort of fundamental driving question behind all of this has been, what is the real nature of reality and how do we come to know that reality? Mm-hmm. And so for me, a lot of that, I said, well, you know, let's start with the brain. I mean, that seemed kind of a logical starting point. That's the part of our being that helps us to receive information from the world and read and think and learn and feel. And so I got to study the brain and see how that's working. And I did a lot of that as I was going through my educational development and school, try to study neuroscience and understand all of that. But as I got into college, I guess, and continued to really reflect on where I was in my journey to answer this big question, I began to realize that as great as science is, and I love science to this day, that there seem to be some interesting elements to these questions that science really struggles with, and maybe even goes beyond science, and things like the nature of our consciousness and these sort of metaphysical questions. And so I started to look at other avenues, which included theological approaches and philosophical approaches. And so I started to take courses in philosophy and theology and comparative religions and things like that, with the hope that maybe that would, you know, add to the conversation in my own mind and help me towards trying to get to the answer to these questions. And ultimately, all of that was kind of swirling around as I got into medical school and was, you know, had this incredible opportunities to start to do imaging studies of the brain. And we did a lot of very traditional stuff, looking at things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and depression. And then at one point I said, well, gee, you know, if we can do brain scans of people with Alzheimer's and depression, why can't we do brain scans of people with different religious beliefs or doing different practices? And so that was what really set off the whole, entrance into this idea of neurotheology and really kind of combining the neurosciences with the religious and spiritual. But it was really because of all of that, I really feel that to me, you still need really both sides of this discussion. And so to me, that's part of why I, while the term neurotheology may not necessarily be the very best of terms, it is a good term. And I think it works if you define the neuro side very broadly and you talk about neuroscience and neuroimaging and psychology and medicine even. And then the theology side, obviously, I'm sure many of your listeners understand what theology is as a kind of a field of work and a great deal of scholarship and thought and so forth that goes into theology itself. But it also needs to be expanded beyond that and thinking about our beliefs and our experiences and our practices. And so, to me, at some level, I guess all of this has been kind of my combined spiritual and scientific journey, hoping that someday with some combination, which I'm still all trying to work out, I'll get to an answer that will be satisfactory to all sides. But as I always tell people, if I do figure it out, I will certainly let everyone know. But I won't keep it to myself. But I do think that because of the complexity of the questions and the challenging elements of them, and the philosophical, theological, biological pieces to all of it, I feel like you need some kind of integrated and combined approach. And I don't know exactly what that means. I don't know if it's 50-50 or 90-10 or, you know, whatever. But that to me is also part of what I think neurotheology is kind of about, which is being careful about what we do, trying to do good research, good scholarship, look at things in a very systematic way, ask a lot of questions, be careful about the conclusions that you draw. But with the ultimate goal of trying to get to the answer of these very fundamental questions about, you know, who we are as human beings and how we perceive and understand the reality around us.
That's beautiful. And Dr. Greenberg, I love the way I feel that sense of restlessness in your work of fresh pursuit and of exploring and being experimental and jamming it out as you go and feeling free to, you know, mix stuff up in the lab that hasn't been done before quite this way. I'm so curious because given the world that I come from, historically, at least, there's been a lot of suspicion of science. I hope we're moving along in terms of, like, we're slightly less likely to kill scientists.
Yeah, I hope so. I certainly hope that's true.
Because they threaten our belief system in some way. Is there as deep a suspicion of theology within the other side of your discipline of neurology and science as the other way around?
Well, obviously there's a whole continuum of people. And I would say that, you know, when you have people on the far side of both of these, ways of thinking, if you have a very, very staunch atheist, materialist, when they come to some of my work, because I am, you know, at least open to the religious and the spiritual and what it may mean, and could there be something beyond kind of the physical world? I'm not saying that there is, but I'm certainly open to that as a possibility. They don't like that. And then certainly, you know, for somebody who is deeply religious, while it might be interesting to know what your brain does when you're speaking in tongues, obviously it doesn't change, you know, that you are doing it or why you are doing it or the experiences that you have. You're religious because you feel religious. Sure. Whether we have some information about the brain, you know, is again, it might be intriguing, but it doesn't really have any fundamental relevance to a person who has that deeply religious perspective. But for the large majority of people who have, you know, kind of are in the middle of those two, you know, very strong extremes, I think there is a lot of interest in trying to understand this relationship. I certainly know of a lot of people, certainly in the medical world, who appreciate the importance of religion and spirituality in people's lives and feel that that's an important part of helping to take care of them in some form or another, at least being open to how important it is for people in terms of the way they cope or deal with different illnesses. I certainly know, you know, many religious individuals who are very intrigued about what's going on in our brain and in our body, and they feel like that's an appropriate thing to do. I mean, as I guess the analogous story often is that if you, you know, give your kid a little fire truck or something like that for Christmas or whatever, and then you come back an hour later and they're taking it apart and they're looking into it, you're like, wow, this is great. You know, they're curious and they're trying to learn about it. Why shouldn't we strive to, you know, if God made us, then why shouldn't we sort of take ourselves apart and try to explore what we are and how we work and try to understand that more. So I think, you know, I may be somewhat blindly naive, but for the most part, I've had a wonderful time being able to talk about this with people of all different perspectives, including people who are atheists and people who are deeply religious. I think there's always still an appreciation for learning about something. Even if you are a pure materialist, don't you want to understand, you know, what's going on in the brain of somebody who isn't and why they feel a different way than you do? So I think, you know, no matter what perspective one takes, there's something within neurotheology which has value. And sometimes it can be very pragmatic. It could be how does meditation or prayer help us to cope or help us to deal with anxiety in some effective way, to thinking about the mind and consciousness and how that all interweaves with the brain, to really, you know, truly philosophical or theological questions. If a person experiences salvation or revelation, what part of them experiences that? You know, is it their soul? Is it their brain? I mean, at some point, the brain's part of that process, even if it's, you know, how they speak about it or think about it or behave about it. So there's a lot of fascinating questions, I think, that come up within the world of neurotheology. And that, to me, is what makes it a very vibrant and a very dynamic kind of area of work to do. Because as much as I've done, I mean, we're really just scratching the surface. There's so much more for us to be able to explore and to look at.
You know, even the way you say that there, your analogy of the child when they have the toy and then they take it apart. I know that for a lot of religious folks that I know, they fear that kind of taking apart, because for them, that's synonymous with demystifying or debunking in some way. And I always feel like with your work, it's kind of the opposite of that, in taking the thing apart, that there's such a deep reverence for these big questions. The spirit of it is not at all trying to demystify or to make it, or, you know, to take away someone's sense of the sacred.
Right.
I
completely agree. And, one of the questions I often ask my students in a very scientific way is, you say, well, look at our brain. You know, we have neurons, we have, you know, billions of neurons, quadrillions of interconnections. We have dopamine and serotonin, and we have electrical discharges. And, you know, it's like, where in all of that are your thoughts? You know, and so the mystery is still there. You know, we have no idea how it really worked. But again, you know, trying to learn about it, trying to understand about it, trying to find out what it is that makes us who we are, I think is in many ways, you know, very, to use the religious term, miraculous. I mean, it's unbelievable how complex we are. And it is amazing that we have, that our minds and our brains are able to do all the things that we're able to do.
Mm. Sexuality being one of those wonders, one of those endless mysteries. I love with the book, and to even give it a little context in terms of where I come from here, it's so interesting growing up in a world where, because the Pentecostal context in so many ways is very embodied, sweaty, you know, dancing. There's a way in which I felt like I learned to be comfortable in my body in a way. Yet there's another way that in the Pentecostal tradition and so much of Christian tradition, as you address in the book, sometimes err on the side of being more disembodied, and other ways that we don't know what to do with our sexuality, or the whole relationship is one kind of a suppression. I know for a lot of people who follow my work and what's happening with the Zeitgeist, there'd be a lot of people who are in some process of kind of theological transition. Maybe they came out of a space, where there was purity culture, like a sense of really strict rules around sexuality, but maybe in a place now where that doesn't feel helpful anymore, and trying to figure out what it means to kind of fully inhabit their own bodies. I would just love to hear what you would say to those folks, and even the way that you, you know, examine religious traditions, sometimes being embodied in some ways, sometimes kind of radically disembodied, a strong sense of separation between body and soul or spirit, however that's put.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that, this is part of what I do try to address to some degree in Sex, God, and the Brain. And, you know, there's a number of ways of taking it. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, to sort of your first question about, you know, what are the differences and the similarities? And, you know, part of the argument is that spirituality and sexuality are, you know, a lot of that is interconnected at the level of our brain. And so, on one hand, you can understand why one group of individuals may say, well, gee, it's going to interfere, you know, that there's, that's part of the problem. And so we need to keep things separate. Now, you know, what I don't have an answer for is why some groups specifically decide to do that versus not, but some groups decide that, you know, there's too much overlap, and so we need to separate them. It interferes with your ability, you know, sexuality will interfere with your ability to be spiritual. And then on the other hand, as you mentioned, there are certainly many spiritual groups in the world, and Buddhist and Hindu, for example, traditions where the idea of, you know, utilizing this very powerful energy, the sexual energy that is a part of us, is a great avenue towards achieving the spiritual. And so they kind of embrace that connection. And so, you know, I can kind of see it going both ways. I mean, I guess some of it does have to do a little bit with just overall perspective on these different ideas on how we are religious and spiritual, on the approaches one should take. And that is part of what I explore. I mean, you know, one of the things that I bring up, which I, you know, for the people specifically who follow the Bible, you know, I think one of the things that is kind of fascinating that often gets kind of glossed over very quickly is that if you, you know, go to the book of Genesis and you look at when human beings are first created by God, God creates human beings. And the very first thing God, you know, says to us before God says, make a religion, say a prayer.
Yeah.
God says, be fruitful and multiply. And so there's sort of this understanding that the very first thing God tells us to do is to be sexual. And so I think there is a kind of understanding of the, you know, obviously it's essential for us to propagate who we are as human beings, our species.
Yeah.
But I think there is something to be said for the power and the value of that. In fact, you know, the covenant with God and Abraham and the idea of using circumcision as a as an approach to, I mean, again, you're talking about sexuality and the sexual organs and so forth. So they're really, it's amazing, you know, how much emphasis and overlap there is. And I think, you know, I guess part of what I hope comes out of the book is a better appreciation for this interaction and and maybe a more positive, more productive way of realizing how we can kind of bring these two very important aspects of humanity together in ways that are beneficial. And you know, obviously, you know, sexuality is an incredible expression of human love and that connection that one makes. And even you know, the Pope, for example, has talked about sexuality as kind of reflecting the connection that human beings have with God. I mean, it, you know, you hope for that deep, intimate, you know, giving everything over as part of that experience. And so I think people, you know, certainly realize that potential relationship. And it is, again, it kind of comes down to what kind of makes sense to each person as to the best way to approach that. But, you know, it can be done. I mean, that to me, you know, in the world of neurotheology, I mean, part of what I also find fascinating is this incredible array of how people engage spirituality. And some people, it's very personal, and some people, it's very social, and some people, it's all about prayer, and some people, it's all about ritual, and some people, it's all about ceremony. Some people want to study the sacred texts. Other people want to just, you know, be in prayer and don't worry so much about, you know. So I mean, this is part of, this goes back to the first question, which is that I think almost all of us look at everything a little bit differently. As I often like to say, if there's 8 billion people on the planet, there's 8 billion different religions. No two people look at anything exactly the same. And that's because our genetics are all different. How much dopamine we have is different. How, you know, what's happened to us in our lives, our parents, our friends, our teachers, our good things that have happened to us, the traumas that have happened to us that bring us to where we are now. Every one of us has a unique story and a unique path. And so we're all going to look at the, you know, everything a little bit different, what we feel, what we think. All, you know, I could have 100 people all reading the same passage or all saying the same prayer. And they're all going to do it a little bit differently and emphasize one thing a little bit more, a little bit less, feel something a little bit more, a little bit less. And that's, to me, also part of what makes neurotheology very exciting, is to look, you know, not just at the, well, what happens to all of us, but what happens on that individual level and makes each one of us really have that ability to have that connection.
Yes, I love that. And I love that you brought up the verse in Genesis, because there is a way that for those of us that come from Jewish and Christian traditions, I mean, really the story starts kind of radically embodied. As you said, before there's any kind of liturgy, before any law, before any commandments, be fruitful and multiply. And then so much of then what follows is kind of all about what you do with your pots and pans and your genitals. You know, it's just very like it's much
many times
more,
that's true.
Yeah. So it's just like it's so embodied in that way. In general, I found your work, and this might be a little bit more of a 30,000 foot question. You're so positive in your evaluation of what faith, what belief can do, the constructive force it can be in people's lives. But I have found it really helpful too, when you, and I think this is more probably to how God changes your brain. But when you talk about the ways that the instances in which religion does become toxic, the handful of particular beliefs or ideology that keep religion from being more of a productive, constructive, life-giving force in people's lives. I'd love if you could speak to that a bit in terms of what are the exceptions when you find that religion's not necessarily healthy so much for our brains and our bodies.
Yeah, well, and actually, that it's a pretty big focus of the book Sex, God, and the Brain, too, because sexuality is kind of similar. It can be a wonderful thing as you know, connecting a married couple, and it's part of the intimacy and the connection that you form. And obviously, it can turn into to terrible things, and you know, even things like rape and so forth. So, I think this to me is actually a very important area for neurotheology to look at. I don't think enough, very little has really been done on it. There are some, some textbooks and articles that have been written about the negative sides of religion, but very little has been really done, at least, especially in the context of the brain. And I do talk about that because, as you mentioned, I think it is extremely important for people to realize that while, there can be a person who says, I am deeply religious, and because of that, I am going to go out and be kind and compassionate and help people and try to heal people. And I'm open to people of other beliefs. So people can take that kind of perspective as a deeply religious person. And then there's other deeply religious individuals who say, I'm going to, strap a bomb around my chest and kill people who don't believe the way that I do. And obviously that's one extreme. Perhaps a more common extreme that a number of people probably know about is when people just kind of begin to view religion very negatively. And sometimes this happens in the context of a trauma. The loss of a loved one, of a child or something like that. And what is the difference in the brain of somebody who turns towards God in that kind of a circumstance? God's going to help me through this particular trial and tribulation in my life. And other people say, why is God doing this? I hate God. I reject God. I'm going to go away from God because of what's happened. The short answer is we don't know. I don't really know what is the difference in the brain of somebody who goes, into a more positive versus a negative direction. And that is why I say I hope that some of the future research that gets done is to be able to start to look at this and try to look at the brain of people who say, these kind of, negative behaviors and killing people in the name of God, that makes sense to me. Versus those people who say, God is loves all of us. And if I'm going to believe in God, then I should love everyone, including our enemies, which I know certainly is one of the things that Jesus talks about in the gospel. So, but that's difficult for us as human beings to do. And so, I think, part of what there are also different ways of starting to look at that. And so, for example, and this even goes back to your very first question about, what are the similarities, for example, between speaking in tongues and sexuality? Well, two specific things come to mind in that regard. And you talk about different changes that are going on in the brain. Well, one of the things that we noticed in speaking in tongues is, as well as in other spiritual practices, and as well as in even when you're using sexuality as part of that, is that we notice a decrease of activity in an area of our brain called the parietal lobe. And this is an area, it's located in the back part of our brain that normally takes sensory information and helps us to kind of create a spatial representation of ourself. And so what we have found is, so this is an area that when it turns on, it kind of creates where ourself is in the world and how we differentiate ourselves from the world. And then in these spiritual practices, this area starts to quiet down. And so we lose our sense of self. We lose the boundary between ourself and other, and that other can be other people. It can, people of our congregation. It can be people in our society. It could be, we feel connected to all Americans, for example. It can be all humanity. It could be the universe, it could be God, but it is that sense of oneness and connectedness, which is kind of fundamental. And one of the things that has occurred to me over the years is we talk about, how does this get induced? And again, it is through often these different kinds of rituals and different practices. But what we have also argued is that these rituals are kind of a morally neutral technology. And what we mean is that it's kind of what you feel connected to that establishes whether you're going to be inclusive or exclusive. And so if you feel connected to all of humanity, then you love all of humanity and you have become inclusive of everyone. But if you only feel connected to your group, then everyone outside of that group now is not your group. And so why are they not part of, why don't they believe the way we do? There must be something wrong with them. Maybe they're confused at best, and maybe they're evil at worst. And so that ability to kind of think very negatively about the other, may have a lot to do with the different practices that people do, and the feeling of connectivity that we have. What do we feel at one with? And that ultimately can be a very important player in terms of this negative side of thing. I think there's probably other elements as well. I mean, obviously, a lot of this may come down to some very primal kinds of feelings. And you think about, another part, and this goes back, I'm answering the first question you ask again. One of the other things that we talk about a lot in terms of spiritual experiences and practices is what's called the autonomic nervous system. And that there's two arms of the autonomic nervous system. One arm is the arousal system and gets us, ready to go and ready to react to different things in our environment. The other is the calming side, and that gets us to relax and to sleep and so forth. Well, that's also part of what leads to aggression or non-aggression. If we are feeling calm and relaxed, then we have positive emotions. We feel connected to people. We have a feeling of calmness and blissfulness, which kind of takes us over, and we feel good. On the other hand, if we get to a feeling of profound arousal and activity, sometimes that can be good. Sometimes it can be a very charismatic, evangelistic kind of feeling, and you feel ecstatic and a great deal of energy. But that's also very close, unfortunately, in the brain to the areas that get us ready for the fight or flight response. And sometimes it leads to fight, and that can lead to a great deal of anger and hatred and so forth. So I think, we have a long way to go in terms of studying this, because very little has truly been done. But I do hope that someday, if we start to do that, we will actually be able to, not only understand it better, but we might be able to help people to, redirect them. I don't know what the right word is, but to, find a different path that leads them more to a positive way of thinking as opposed to a negative way of thinking.
Gosh, I'm so fascinated by this whole thing, because on the one hand, it's so immediate for me, that connection between, even just all my experience in Pentecostal worship, the way that there is at best a kind of surrender, not just to God, but to the people around you that is very vulnerable, that is very intimate. And there being a real beauty to that, but then the fact that that can be maybe only a stone's throw away from a very different kind of surrender to other kinds of emotions and lowering inhibitions for, I'm always so fascinated. For example, if people feel like they're drawing close to some kind of a larger mystery, it would seem like whether or not you believe that reality is fundamentally punitive or not, probably makes a pretty big difference, what that connection is.
Yeah. And I mean, that is very much a part of it too. And we talk about rituals and the different practices and so forth, but the mythic content, when we use myth, myself and my late colleague, we don't mean myth in the kind of pejorative way that we typically, the myth of dieting and that it's false and so forth. What we're talking about are these, fundamental stories that help us to understand the world. And as you said, I mean, if that story is about love and compassion, then that's what we feel connected to. And then we go forth with love and compassion. And if the story is about anger and hatred, then that's what we go forth with. Mm-hmm. But you also bring up, and I know I keep going back to answering your very first question of the interview, please. Which is, the other area of the brain that we found that is different in people when they're speaking, the changes when people are speaking in tongues and how that's similar, for example, to sexuality, is the frontal lobe. Because you just talked about the concept of surrender, which I think is a very, very important piece to all of this. And so when we are purposely doing things, our frontal lobe, which is right behind our forehead, turns on. This is the area of our brain that helps us to focus our attention, that helps us to initiate our behaviors. And so if we're, driving our car, if we're speaking regularly, like we're talking right now, we're using parts of our frontal lobe to generate our language, to generate our behaviors. But what we have also found is that in the midst of these very deep spiritual practices, when you have that feeling of surrender, you kind of give away your purposefulness, your concentration, your making things happen, and you are kind of pulled along for the ride, so to speak, and you surrender. And when that happens, your frontal lobe activity goes down. So when we looked at people speaking in tongues, their frontal lobe activity went down. We see this in other practices where a person feels that sense of release, letting go, again, different words, but that feeling of surrender. But also, again, to your point, part of what then happens, part of what the frontal lobe also does for all of us is kind of keeps, I always think about this as like, you know, like the big file cabinet in your brain. It kind of keeps everything that you think and do in some kind of order. So when it drops, it now does open you up. As you mentioned, you know, it kind of makes you vulnerable. It makes you vulnerable because now no one's really watching these files right now.
Yeah,
and so people can start swapping them out. You could throw them up in the air and put them back. And, you know, now sometimes that leads to wonderfully positive experiences that change, you know, fundamentally how a person is, and that these are the enlightenment experiences, the conversion experiences and so forth that really change the way a person thinks about the world. Many times they are incredibly positive, and that's great. And it kind of change, you know, that they're transformative in a good way. But they can be transformative in a bad way. And it does give, you know, a nefarious person, a cult leader, for example, an opportunity to start implanting ideas that maybe, you know, before you got into all of this ritual, doesn't sound like such a great idea, but now it kind of makes sense. And so, so again, you know, we have to be kind of cautious and careful, but these also may be the avenues through which we can redirect people. If we get, you know, we talk about this and how God changes your brain about, you know, if you want to change yourself, you know, part of it is to make a conscious effort to do that. So if you want to be more compassionate, you know, part of how you do that is to think about being more compassionate. And, you know, the more you focus on being compassionate and saying loving thoughts and thinking positively about others and doing charitable work and being altruistic. Well, you know, as the saying goes, neurons that fire together, wire together. And so the more you do those good behaviors, the more those neural connections form and the more you continue down that path. And so you literally can change the nature of who you are. But unfortunately, I mean, it can go in both directions. And, and, you know, maybe the last thing to say, which is maybe the scariest thing, is that if you, you know, there fortunately hasn't been a whole lot of data on this, but there have been some studies, most of these much older studies, because I don't know if people will be allowed to do them anymore, where they kind of tell you that all of us can be kind of turned into something bad. You know, we, or at least we have that potential, you know, if you put somebody, these are experiments where they would, you know, tell people to give shocks to other people, or there was something called the Stanford Prison Experiments, where they just arbitrarily made some people guards and some people prisoners, and they had to stop the study after like 3 days because they're getting ready to kill each other. Wow. So, you know, and these were otherwise just totally normal people, but because you now establish that you're one thing and you're another, all different kinds of, you know, strange interactions start to occur, and I don't trust them, and they, you know, and all of a sudden your mind kind of runs away with you. So it is a little scary that a lot of our minds, you know, have the potential to be altered. If we're limited in what we can learn, if we are, you know, put into, you know, various abusive or, you know, challenging problems, you know, it is difficult to continue to, you know, find the moral high ground at times when the rest of the way everything is being set up for you is going in an opposite direction. So it can be very challenging. And again, learning about that and trying to see what's going on in the brain is going to be important for us to learn about those experiences and hopefully learn how to avoid them or at least change them.
That's so helpful, especially in the moment that we're in politically and all that, because one of my concerns for those of us who come out of more kind of high control religions is that when you're used to kind of the messaging that someone is, that you know, is kind of like Moses and they're coming down from the mountain with the word of God and whatever they say goes, I'm just seeing so much around me in terms of the way that can prepare people for a kind of authoritarianism.
Right.
That can just be, again, maybe at best could be used in a constructive direction. Like, oh, if Dr. King is the charismatic figure you're drawn to, that's one thing.
That's right.
But when they're very different kinds of ideas, just how dangerous that can be when there's already, would it be fair to say then a kind of hard wiring for that kind of authoritarianism?
Yeah, well, you know, this is something that also I talk about in Sex, God, and the Brain, because if you kind of take a broader evolutionary perspective of humanity and you think, I mean, this is part of where all of this whole idea came from. It goes back to some early work that I did with my late mentor, who was an anthropologist as well as a psychiatrist. And we talked a lot about, well, you know, how, what was the evolution of the human brain and what elements from animals theoretically, you know, became part of the human brain. And one of them has to do with social hierarchy, which actually is still connected to ritual and ultimately to mating, because it, it's who you get to mate with. Are they in your league, so to speak? But, you know, all animals that have social hierarchies find themselves in this kind of pattern of having, you know, some kind of queen bee or alpha male or something like that. And then everybody kind of falls, you know, in line behind that. Now, you are entitled to challenge the alpha. However, you know, like one of the things I never understood to me was like, well, if somebody challenges the alpha and they just, you know, they barely, you know, they just lose, but they lose, like, why don't they just challenge again? I mean, like they were pretty close, you know, maybe they'll get lucky this time, but they don't. There's sort of this, this deference to the alphas. And again, you see this in all different kinds of displays, like bowing, you know, they will bow down. And just like human beings bow down, or take a knee or whatever. And again, sometimes that's okay. I mean, if it's appropriate to bow to God, for example. But, and maybe it's appropriate to bow to a king or something like that. But, you know, at some point that behavior is kind of built into us because it helps to maintain this whole cohesive social hierarchy, which if you, you know, If you kept changing alphas, you know, and queen bees every, you know, every other day, well, the whole social structure would start to fall apart and no one would know where they fit and no one would understand what's going on. You know, I mean, it's, you know, you could take, there's all kinds of, you take the analogy like a football team. I mean, if you change your coach every week, you're going to have a pretty bad football team because they're not going to know what's going on. You need somebody who is an authoritarian figure that everyone basically, you know, kind of bows down to and follows what they say. Now, if that coach is, you know, Vince Lombardi or you know, one of the great coaches, then it's great and it works and it's wonderful. But again, even there, you know, you still have people, you have the quarterback who is, you know, maybe next in the hierarchy, and then you know, the running back or whatever. So everybody kind of knows their place on the team, and that makes everything work very smoothly. If suddenly, you know, the third string wide receiver wants to be the first string, you know, things start to get confused. And if there isn't somebody at the top who kind of keeps that all under control, then the system really does start to fall apart. So, so we do, you know, again, it's kind of built into our biology. You know, if you now extrapolate this to humanity, well, we operate in much the same way, and we have a king or a president or whatever. We have, you know, people under them. We have people under them. We have bosses. We have people who work for us. So there's this whole social hierarchy that, as long as everything kind of fits in place, works well. But it does set us up in certain ways that we can sometimes end up listening to things or following things in ways which you know, which wind up being to our detriment. And if we don't have that level of comfort, then, you know, we either do things we shouldn't be doing, or ultimately, if we really feel we have no choice but to go against the prevailing hierarchy, then you get like an American Revolution, and you have to change the total structure. And that does, you know, again, I think it's ultimately appropriate that that happens from time to time. But it you know, it does set us up for the potential for both positive and negative ways of worshiping, so to speak, those who are in charge and following those individuals. And again, you know, that the downside can be that you can follow people to very negative ideas and behaviors, or, you know, hopefully it leads us to more positive ones, but it doesn't always work that way.
You know, I didn't plan to ask this, but since we are talking about, and even, you know, social structure and hierarchy and how our brains get wired the way they are and all that, I'm so curious what it's like for you in the midst of this volatile election process that will go on for like however long. What's kind of lighting up for you right now in terms of what you know about how our brains work and what you're reading in the news every day? Like, more like just a riff today, like on this Friday afternoon, what's screaming at you in terms of how what you're seeing happening in the world intersects with your work?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it does have a lot to do with what we were talking about a little while ago about, you know, what do you feel connected to?
Yeah.
So that's part of it. And I actually wrote a book a number of years ago didn't get a real popular play, but it was one of my favorite books. It was called Why We Believe What We Believe. And
yes,
and part of what I was talking about in that book was a kind of very simple issue, which is that we have to have some mythic story in our mind about how the world works.
Sure.
And every one of us has to have that. We have to, you know, why do we get up in the morning? Why do we go to work? We want money. Why do we want money? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, like, so there's a story in our mind about how reality works. And for the most part, we come up with a story that works for us. And so it could be we're a religious person. It could be we're not a religious person. It could be a Republican. We're a Democrat, whatever it is, that we kind of look at the world in a certain way that works for us. Now, as we go out into the world, there's different pieces of data that we encounter all the time. Some of those pieces of data are consistent with our worldview and others are go against it. So if, let's say, we come across a person at the bus stop or at our work who, you know, we're talking to them and we say, well, you know, we think, you know, one presidential candidate should be the one who wins, and they say the other one. So, you know, what do we do with that? So when we confront somebody who doesn't believe what we believe and they're espousing a different belief system, our brain now has two choices.
Mm.
The choice one is I'm right and they're wrong. Or they're right and I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, which one is our brain going to choose? Well, I would say about 95% of the time, our brain is going to choose that we're right, you know, sure. that I'm right. Because if I don't know reality well, then that's going to elicit a very prominent stress response. It's going mm-hmm. to be very anxiety provoking because if I don't understand the world, my survival, you know, literally my survival is at stake here. You know, I'm not mm-hmm. seeing the world right. What I thought I was supposed to be doing, I'm doing wrong. And so it's much easier for me to say, no, you know, I'm right. Clearly they're wrong. I'm okay. You know, I take a deep breath, but then, you know, it's like, well, you know, how come they keep sending me emails to tell me why I'm wrong? How come they keep telling me that I'm wrong? So part of the problem is that now we're like, well, you know, there must be something either wrong with them. Maybe there's something evil with them. You know, why would they keep doing this when clearly they're wrong? Mm. It's true of all ideas. I mean, and look, this is true beyond politics. I mean, this is true in science as well. I mean, there was the old sort of, I don't know who came up with the saying that science precedes one funeral at a time because, you know, you have to kind of get rid of the old guard to bring in the new ideas. And I mean, I've seen this hundreds of times in my medical career where there was like a way of treating people and then somebody comes up with a new way of doing it and everybody's like, oh, that's crazy. The studies are bad, this, that, you know, they just reject it out of hand. And then, you know, 10 years down the road, we're doing it the new way because that turned out to be the right way to do it.
Yeah.
So we all have this inherent ability to sort of reject ideas, people, and so forth, and information that go against our belief system. And then when we see something that supports our belief, that says why I should vote for this person, or this is, you know, that's why I should believe, you know, in this tradition or something like that. So we're always kind of looking for the ways in which we can support our beliefs, and usually we're pretty vehement in rejecting ideas that go against us. And so now to really answer the final answer to this question is, when you look at kind of the social media world, and I know a lot of people are talking about that, this is kind of the problem with it, because on a daily, you know, moment to moment basis, we can go on the internet, or we can go on, you know, a podcast or whatever, Twitter or whatever, and we can find all the things that support things that make sense to us and support our beliefs, and we can reject or ignore all the thing. And in fact, the algorithms which are designed, I mean, when I learned more about these algorithms, I was like, well, this makes so much sense, because the algorithms are not based on what's right or wrong.
Right.
It's how much you're willing to look at them.
Yeah.
So if you know, to take the example, if you're a Republican and you're, you know, you go online and you're going to spend, you know, 3 minutes looking at a story that's positive for Republicans and only 3 seconds for a story that is against, well, now you're just going to get more and more and more, you know, learning about what supports your beliefs. And of course, this is true, you know, for the Democrats too. So it goes both ways. But I think this is really, you know, the problem that we kind of all have to face, which is, how do we sort of get outside of our own biases and our own beliefs enough in a way that we can feel comfortable, but also look at the other side and try to appreciate the other side, try to understand the other side, even if we decide ultimately that we don't agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me is part of it. And it does go back. I mean, this is, again, to be the idealist here. And this is part of where I hope neurotheology helps us, mm-hmm. because what it does tell us is, look, you know, even if you think, you know, this is my political belief or this is my religious belief, and everybody in my congregation or everybody on my block, you know, we all going to vote the same way,
right.
or we must all be right. You know, that to me, part of the issue there is that, you know, we have to kind of realize that everybody's still thinking slightly different. Everybody's sure. voting for one of these candidates. It's because one's worried about abortion. One's worried about the economy. One's worried about this. One's worried about that. And we're all worried about things in slightly different ways. So all of us really have different perspectives. And part of it is to appreciate the fact that maybe the fact that somebody believes something different than us isn't because they're bad or evil. It's just, it's their combination of everything that has brought them to that point. And so that's one of the things that I do hope kind of comes out of this search, which is the appreciation for alternative perspectives, and also that you know, all of us are ultimate. You know, maybe we should be a little bit more compassionate and understanding for people who've come to conclusions which are different than ours, because they obviously just, you know, see the world a little bit differently, but not necessarily wrongly.
That's so helpful. The last couple of weeks, I've been messing around with, you know, my Christian context, St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, the line that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers. I've been saying that we wrestle against algorithms, because it does feel like that. Then, you know, it's kind of like the machine and where that takes us. And if I can slide in one last question real quick, this is a personal one. I love because I do love the way you talk about how God, the idea of how God changes the brain, how we can change our own brains. And I know maybe returning again full circle, as you've done a few times, to like the first question, it's been fascinating for me coming from the world that I do, where so much of my early formation was around these Pentecostal practices of, you know, tongues, shouting, dancing, all that. But then later in life, so much of my spiritual development has been grounded in liturgy, where now a lot of what I found myself doing is, you know, praying the Jesus prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, over and over again, or praying the Lord's Prayer and those kinds of things. I have no data for this, but anecdotally, what it seems like is that those liturgical practices, I feel like, have much the same effect on me that the Pentecostal practices did, in terms of connecting to, maybe transcending the intellect on one level, coming into a deeper part of myself. Is there something to that neurologically?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, playing off of what we just talked about this sort of individual, you know, differences that we all have, to use the trite analogy, I mean, you know, it's what is the combination to the lock, and we all have a different lock. And so, you know, for somebody to take your story, while, you know, you may have begun in, you know, in going down one path or experiencing certain kinds of states or practices, they had an effect on you. And, you know, some of those effects may have been good. Some of them may have felt confused by or whatever. And now you found a different path, which is also able to stimulate these kinds of experiences, but, you know, works right for you. And that's in part why there's thousands of different prayers and meditation practices and so forth, because there isn't a one size fits all. And each person does have to kind of find what works best for them. And for some, it goes back to, I think, one of my earlier answers to your questions also, that, you know, for some of us, our spirituality is embedded in emotions, and for some it's more cognitive, and for some it's through dance and charismatic practices, and for some it's, you know, being in solitude or being in nature. So, you know, each of us can kind of, to me, the exciting part is that we all have this ability. I mean, if you look at all of our brains, we all have frontal lobes and parietal lobes and autonomic nerves. You know, we all have the same, these areas and functions that we've talked about, but they do all work a little bit differently. And what makes one, I mean, this is part of why some people go into mathematics and other people go into history and some people love poetry and some people like rock and roll and some people like classical. So, you know, the beauty of our brains in their infinite diversity is that, that all of us kind of find, have the potential to find a slightly different path and to find the things that turn on that system. But again, it does come back to this idea, as I keep talking about, that I've proposed many years ago and continue to find data to support this, that there's this really this whole very complex network of structures in the brain and functions of the brain. But, there's the kind of the bottom up, which is the dancing and the charismatic approaches. There can be very cognitive through meditation or through language and the study of liturgy or reading sacred texts. So there, and any and all combinations, you know, and so, again, there's, it's very multifactorial, and that's part of why, so many of even the rituals that I talk about in Sex, God, and the Brain, I mean, they invoke, it's not like they just, they're not visual, it's not just they're visual, they're visual, sure. they stimulate this, they have sounds, they have tastes, they have smells, they have motions, they have, there's, you know, and they all have it to different kinds of ways. Some are much more sedate, some are much more active, some are more visual, some are less visual. So it, you know, and they all have the potential to affect us. And, and I think that's part of, I mean, at least from kind of an overall kind of brain health perspective, we talk about trying to activate and utilize the brain in as many ways as possible, because it is designed to be able to work in all those different ways. But it does, it comes down to that. And to just, you know, one last time, sort of tying it into sexuality. I mean, a lot of this rises out of the whole mating process. And that's also why some people like somebody with a great sense of humor, and some people want somebody who's really smart, and some people want somebody who's really analytical, and some people want somebody who loves to dance, and and so what makes us fall in love with any given individual, again, is also multifactorial, and part of the whole point of these rituals and the practices that kind of lead us down both a spiritual or a sexual path is that you're working towards finding the key that unlocks your spirit or unlocks your heart, depending on the circumstances. But many times there's a lot of overlap. And from a purely evolutionary perspective, it makes sense that part of what's been discussed is that because we are all kind of searching for the same answers together, when we find a person who's kind of going down that same path, that becomes a very powerful way of making that connection. And that's why spirituality or religion is, you know, can be a very important part of a relationship, at some level. And of course, sometimes it can tear a relationship apart if people are really going in opposite directions.
Sure. Dr. Niebuhr, thank you so much. Thank you for your work. It's so wonderful that you do so much on the brain in such a heart first and soulful way. I mean, and giving permission for all of these kind of journeys that we're on. And again, just a huge fan, and especially grateful that you've just made me infinitely cooler to my wife. That really is that's a
you
real
found the stuff. Right combination to the it's lock.
Just the right combination, so for sure. But what a wonderful conversation. What a gift this is. Thank you for your work. I certainly hope everybody will read Sex, God, and the Brain, and then work their way backwards and read all of your work. It's so helpful. And I'm again grateful, especially for the work that you're pioneering between these fields. Those of us who've been in our little silos of theology and philosophy and liturgy, we need to be have this kind of jailbreak. So thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it and look forward to hearing from you again.
Absolutely. Take care.
All right. Thank you. Take care.